The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain. I want to tell you about a service I've been using for over a year now, Aurora. I signed up and they immediately identified over 60 data brokers out there selling my information. The best part is they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. I have a link down below where you get a 14-day free trial. It's risk-free and you can cancel anytime. So it's worth taking a shot and seeing what information is out there. But it's more than just that. They have an app which includes antivirus, VPN, password management, all built into one package. You can use the app or you can use the browser to stay safe out there in the digital space. Again, I have a link down below. You can check it out for 2 weeks free. And if you don't like it, you can cancel anytime.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At my most memorable combat sortie involved working with Apaches, and it was just kind of an interesting mission.
Tower Demarsh is released to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altura 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector, I'm speeding 538. My bright ramp curve pulls at 354.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to everyone who's been supporting the podcast over on Patreon. Thanks to those who've taken the time to leave a rating review and follow the show over on Spotify and iTunes. I appreciate you guys doing that. If you're watching this, as always, thanks for leaving a comment. Thanks for liking the video and checking that out. Today, got to sit down with my buddy Habu. This one has been a long time coming. But we crossed paths at Southern Fun, finally in person. Unfortunately, I have the E3 Aviation team there. If you're looking to launch your aviation career, or if you're just looking for an awesome experience in the aviation world, check out E3 Aviation. A lot of great content, a lot of great experiences, a lot of great people involved, as well as some great discounts, if you're into that kind of thing. I got that link down below. And again, thanks to E3 Aviation for making this interview possible. We sat down at Sun and Fun. Habu started his career flying in the backseat of the F-15E as a WISO, a weapons systems operator, before going to pilot training and then ultimately moving on to fly at A-10, which he flew for quite some time. He was the A-10 demo pilot at one point, so it was fun to be able to sit down at Sun and Fun and chat with Habu. I think you'll enjoy this conversation. So that being said, let's jump into it with Habu. What's up, everyone? Excited to be sitting here with Habu, man. This is, I've actually had you on my radar scope to pin down an interview with you. And finally, I was like, when you sent me a message, you're gonna be at Sun and Fun. I was like, this is gonna be perfect. So if you're listening or if you're watching, it's easy to see. We're sitting in front of Crazy Horse,
yeah,
in front of Lee Lauterbach, Stallion 51, which we've both flown on his wing. But if you're listening, it might be a little loud because occasionally there's an airplane flying around or people walking around. But Habu, man, it's great to be able to link up and chat and hear a little about your story and
absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having me, for sure. We've got obviously a little bit of a history doing the demo stuff together. So, but beforehand we get too much started, I'll start off. I owe Rain a little gift of gratitude here. So Rain had previously been in the Dubai Air Show and he got a call to help out and he was unable for whatever reason it was, but mentioned me by name. And so I got probably the best, you know, good deal thing that happened in my 21 years in the Air Force, which was to go be the air boss for the Dubai Air. So this is for you, buddy.
Dude,
so yeah,
I appreciate
absolutely,
that, man.
Yeah.
Well, as we were kind of talking beforehand, you know, it's a small Air Force, small network. It's
cool to be able to help one another out. The Dubai Air Show, if anyone hasn't been, is pretty incredible. I mean, sure. It's massive on a scale that's unseen, I think, anywhere else. Sure. Maybe the Paris, I never went to Paris Air Show,
right.
But the fact that you gotta jump in there and capture that good deal, and they didn't go to waste, because
no,
you don't want to go to someone you don't know. You gotta hook a brother up, so.
No, everybody there was great. The air show itself was spectacular. It was almost like being on Star Wars episode, all these different uniforms, all these different things going on, and all these countries, and people are selling weapons and helmets and all these things, so it was pretty spectacular watching some of the civilian and the military performances there. I watched the Russian Knights perform in the Su-27, so that was pretty interesting as well, and then just being in Dubai and experiencing that was pretty cool. So
the one thing from the show that it's still etched in my mind, so it's almost comical. They had like the small little elevator that you ride up to the air boss briefing every day.
Yep.
So one morning I get onto the elevator, and then two Su-35 pilots get onto the elevator.
Right.
And then three Chinese J-10 pilots get on the elevator. And like no one's talking to one another. It's the elevator music playing,
sure.
And you're just like, cool. We're just here to hang out. I will say the Russians, it was the chief test pilots for the Sukhoi Design Bureau.
Okay.
And like one of his assistant chief test pilots. And they were very friendly.
Yeah.
And they wanted to see the F-22, which we had
sitting
on static. And so anyone could go see it. So, hey, sure. But we would also like to go see the Su-35.
Right.
So we had to show them the F-22 first, which like, okay, that's fine. And then the next day we went and got a tour where we're able to walk up underneath that Su-35. And then, there's like a million cameras on you just watching you.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting to see like the geopolitics and
absolutely
just things that are going on. And
they had the checkmate display there as well. So they had it covered up, and it was in this big covered, display, and you could hear the bass like bumping out of it. It was like, so we finally got to go in on the last day, and it was like laser shows, like being in a nightclub, and the whole display, the way that they were talking about the checkmate and all its capabilities and stuff like that. So
was that the unveiling of checkmate for the Russians?
I don't know. I hadn't really followed it that much up until that point. So I didn't, I was kind of surprised to see it there, and we didn't really even think about trying to go in there until, towards the end of it. And we just decided, hey, we're going to stand in line and see if they'll let us in. And they did. They were very excited that we were taking pictures with it and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, I bet they were.
Yeah.
It was interesting to walk around there too, because I know, the Russians, they had their surface-to-air missile defense companies. I forget who makes what. But, SA-17s, they got all the brochures hanging out there, so you just walk around.
Yeah.
But we rounded the corner for one, and it was the Russian Space Agency.
Okay.
And it was comical, just the overtness of this.
Right.
But as we're standing at the counter, just kind of looking at some of their stuff, they're like, oh, Americans? And they reach down below the counter and pick up these two boxes and hand them to us. You open it up, and it's a miniature satellite, which looks really cool.
Yeah.
But it was USB drives. And so you're like, cool.
I'll plug everything. I'm absolutely
not going to use this at all. But so it's,
sure.
We start mixing everyone in those worlds. It's it's quite interesting. But yeah, cool, man. I'm glad you got to do that.
Yeah, thanks again, man. That was great.
Yeah, happy to be here, happy to serve. Thanks for the bottle.
Sure.
Not needed, but I really do appreciate
great.
It. Cracked open later. So, dude, let's back up. Can you tell me a little bit about you? Where did you get the hook to go fly? When did that bug bite you, and how'd you get in the Air Force?
I grew up in Colorado. My parents were school teachers, so I didn't have a big aviation background. It wasn't like, I lived up at 8,500 feet, so there's no airport really near me. But I just, for whatever reason, I just always had a fascination with airplanes. From the time I was a kid, I used to build airplane models, and my dad and I, we actually built an airplane model out of balsa wood. We sanded it down and cut it down and like from scratch, and painted it. And I had the G.I. Joe F-14 hanging from my ceiling in my room, and I was just had always been fascinated with aviation. So pre-9/11, I lived about 25 miles from the Colorado Springs Airport.
Okay.
It was down a mountain pass, and my dad used to take me down to the airport just to watch planes take off and land. So it was kind of in my system, And then as I got a little bit older, I ended up going to the University of Colorado on a ROTC scholarship. Came out of there, and I was a WISO in the Strike Eagle, so backseater in the Strike Eagle. Did that for a while, but I always wanted to work my way up to the front seat. And so the opportunity presented itself and was able to do that. So I deployed to Iraq in the F-15E, and that was a spin-up mission for us doing close air support. learned about nine lions and supporting guys on the ground, and I just kind of became fascinated with it. I felt like it was pretty crazy to check in, take an unknown situation and kind of figure out where everybody was, and you know, not have necessarily a pre-planned thing, but just go off the cuff, you know, off the cusp, taking your bag of tricks, we would say,
right,
and applying it to a situation. So I kind of fell in love with that, and I'd always had a little bit of a thing for the A-10, so I put in to fly A-10s, and I was lucky enough to get that. So
did you do one assignment as a WISO and then get picked up?
I did, yep. And I actually applied before I was technically legal to apply, but I got picked up with the exception that I had to wait. There's a prerequisite time. You had to be, you know, winged for 2 years or two and a half years, I think it was. And so I had to wait. I actually, when I deployed to Iraq, I already knew that I was going to go to pilot training. So the guys in the striking unit I was with let me fly quite a bit, and they, you know, I had a long time to kind of prep. So it was good. It was good for me.
What was your WISO training like? In weapon system officer, backseat, sure. You know, the Strike Eagle?
It was with the Navy. So I checked, you know, I checked out and I went down to Pensacola, Florida. I went through NFO school, they call it, with the Navy. So it was my first Air Force assignment, was learning about all the Navy jargon and, you know, the different differences there, you know, so.
I still don't understand the Navy enlisted system. Like,
I don't either.
I have no idea.
My sister is a commander in the Navy.
Okay.
As a dentist. And so, you know, we talk about that stuff, but obviously the medical field is a little bit different than the aviation side of things. But
it's like, it'd be like, I don't know, chief petty officer dental assistant.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, and they what? Answer that with some kind of, you know, they answer the phone with some 9-letter acronym. That's but it's pretty interesting. So I would answer the phone. I would sit at the duty desk and they'd say, hey, you know, lieutenant in the Navy is an 03, you know, so I would answer the phone as Lieutenant Thorpe. And I was sitting at the desk and my buddies in my class were calling me sir on the phone because they didn't recognize who I was. It's kind of interesting. But
that's when you call a Navy base and you're, you know, an 03, a captain. And
right.
It's like, yeah, you get things done. Like, yeah, sure. It's Captain Waters. I want to bring some jets down there.
Right.
People are jumping. You're like,
yeah, absolutely. Because that's the same as a colonel in the Air Force.
So.
So I went through school there. It was challenging, just like any flight program, you know what I mean? So, at the time there, you could either go to B-1s or F-15Es out of the strike NFO track that I was on. So they had they had two different tracks. One was at Randolph, and then the strike fighter track was down in Pensacola. And oddly enough, I was like, I can't go wrong. Both of those planes are awesome. And then they brought a B-1 down. And I crawled up into the seat where the WISO sits in the B-1. I thought, I don't know if I can do this. You know, their window, they call it the day-night indicator.
Oh.
It's pretty tiny in there. So
the ergonomics of the B-1, because when I did the Dias Air Show, my buddy took me up in the B-1, first time I've ever been. And I was like, the EWO, I can't remember all the, if it's, they have like an electronic warfare officer, right? And then,
yeah, like I think they have an offensive and a defensive systems operator.
But sitting in there and seeing the window, so one, like you think like them in a cast wheel, just in a bank, like, the ergonomics are absolutely terrible.
Sure,
like, it would crush my soul to be sitting back there on like a, especially like a 7, 8, 9, 10 hour, 11 mission. Like, unable.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, anyway, so I decided that I really wanted to push for Strike Eagles after that, and about to do that. So I had a great time in the Strike Eagle. And then, you know, fast forward to when I was in pilot training, after all that work of being a student and getting grade sheets and all that MQT and all that stuff, I finally was in the enjoyable part of being in a fighter. And then I went back to pilot training and all just for the, to take a beating again, you know? So there was multiple times when I was in pilot training going, man, I had a good, pretty good, you know? So, that was challenging, but I think my experience, by that point I had 600 hours in the Strike Eagle. And, the guys that were my age were guys like you who were faint,
The reversers, again, it's great being at Sun and Fun. And
yeah.
I think the reversers on one, maybe a 7.6 was quite loud, but you know, being an older guy, going back to pilot training, right? And then you got guys like me being a FAPE, first-time instructor pilot, who's 23, 24 years old, and then you're obviously a little more seasoned, you've been to combat. There's a balance of like how, like, student with a lot more Air Force experience, maybe not front seat time, but getting there. What were some of those challenges? How'd you deal with it? Or were there any challenges with that?
There's a class, you know, class commander. So I was the guy that was kind of the POC for everything, talking with the flight commanders and stuff. I think just with a mutual respect, a FAPE was an expert at that airplane and I was still learning how to be a pilot. So I knew that their role was to instruct me. And I feel like almost to every single person, the FAPEs were very respectful of the experience that I had. You know, I'd been to combat and they would ask me about things like that. So I didn't feel like it was too much of a challenge because I didn't walk in there with any kind of attitude right. that, hey, I know what I'm doing or I've been there. I was there to learn, you know, so.
I think that was my first exposure, but now, you know, the more you progress in your aviation career, whatever it is, you know, I mean, you start finding yourself in those very similar spots where like, hey, even if you're in the airlines and you're sitting in the right seat, you know, like you might have more time because you just, that's where you wanted to stay sure. versus the guy sitting in the left seat. But
yeah.
again, it's just like this balance in, the, I think, the aviation world of like, hey, you might have a lot of experience, but maybe it's not in this plane and you've got to kind of.
Sure. I think just having an open mind and being willing to learn all the time. Everybody said it before, but, you know, the day I have a perfect flight is the day I'm just going to hang up my headset or my helmet or G suit or whatever it is, you know,
right.
and be like, it's because it's never happened. You know, there's always something to learn, especially when you got a small iceberg like me and the penguins are constantly getting pushed off of there. So.
Global warming really sucks because my iceberg is shrinking on a daily basis. So. I'm like, yep, I definitely don't remember that or this or that. So any like advice you would give for someone in that scenario or, I mean, because again, I think we all find ourselves in that spot that key success, stressful environment, maybe you're balancing too the relationship and some of the subjective, like touchy-feely aspects of
training. You know, I instructed in the A-10 for a very long time, and I think that, you know, one of the big things was just humility. We'd have students that would struggle with certain things, and 90% of it was just attitude. You know, we had guys that were really struggling but wanted to put the effort in. When you saw a guy who, you know, might be struggling with something, but they were open about it and honest about it, and they wanted to put the work in, and they came to you for help, you know, it was very difficult to do anything other than give them your best, you know?
Absolutely. I think I was actually talking to a kid yesterday. And I was like, if you're willing to put in the effort and, you know, if you show the genuine interest and the passion for it, like that's step one. But there, I think the aviation world, you can find someone that if you're putting forth that effort, that someone's willing to match it because we all had someone who helped us out along
Absolutely.
The way. Yeah. So you got to put in a little bit of effort, have a good attitude, but.
Yeah, 1,000%. And you know, as the demo pilot, I would get asked that a lot and you are familiar with it too. And one of the main things I would tell younger kids, especially the high school age, is, hey, control everything that's in your control, right? You can control your GPA, you can control your extracurricular activities, you can control all these things. And then if you put yourself in a position where, you know, the numbers and the data make sense for you to be competitive for something, it's very hard for the person who ultimately makes that decision to not rank you up there pretty high.
I think that's a great way of looking at it. Control the things you can. Because there are pieces like, I'll get someone like, how do I join the Air Force? Something like so basic.
Right.
That you're like, man, in today's age, Google exists.
Sure.
So like sometimes you need to knock out some of the baseline things. Now you might have questions that pop up from it.
Sure.
But at least put in a little bit of the effort and control
Absolutely.
The things
your,
that you can
your
control.
GPA, your physical fitness, you know, those are yours and yours alone. So maximize those things. And then, you know, the rest of it will, almost guarantee will fall into place, you know?
Absolutely. All right, pilot training, you track T-38, so you're on the fighter bomber track. Did you want to go back to the Strike Eagle or what was the decision?
You know, I was back and forth between it. And on one hand, I knew that I would, it's, you know, every time you go to a new airplane, there's new systems and new this and new tactics. And I knew that I could make a pretty seamless transition into that world.
Right.
On the other hand, I really had always, like, when I was down, I was based at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, and we were part of the same wing with the A-10s that were down at Pope at the time.
Right.
And I just always had a fascination with the A-10 as well. So I went back and forth between it, and I thought, you know, at the time, most of my career, the A-10 wasn't going to be around forever. So my deciding factor was, well, I can go to the A-10, and then when it goes away, I can go fly something else. But if I go to the Strike Eagle, I'll probably be there for good. So
right.
I wanted to take an opportunity to fly a new fighter and do a mission and fly a pretty cool airplane, you know?
So I was casual, waiting to go to pilot training at Moody. I was with the HH-60 unit, which was awesome to be able to go fly and kind of see the CSAR piece of it. But when I was down there, that's when the Pope A-10s moved down. So
right.
I do remember the first time I heard the gun go off. I was actually like 10 miles away in my apartment. I'm like, what was
right.
that?
Yeah.
But it was really cool to then see combat search and rescue, how HH-60s, PJs, how
absolutely.
A-10s are doing rescort.
Sure.
That's a super complex mission set.
Really is, yeah.
Did you go through the Sandy profile?
I went up through a Sandy 2. I was on the track to become a Sandy 1, and then I jumped into the demo thing and didn't really get an opportunity. When I went back, I was at an FTU instructor, so there wasn't much opportunity for that. But I did have some experience in it, and I was able to go actually and teach CSAR and a couple different things. I taught CSAR at the Tactical Leadership Program in Spain. I went to Slovenia and taught the PC-9 pilots some CSAR stuff. So I had some experience in it. I wasn't a Sandy one, but.
Well, I mean, and can you talk to me, and for those listening too, sure. Through the Sandy profile, because
yeah.
My understanding, it's obviously it's a completely different mission set than anything I've ever
sure.
done, but each one of those, like a Sandy 4, Sandy 3, Sandy 2, Sandy 1, is an in-depth upgrade. And then like to put all that together with, you know, just the logistics of the squadron, the training profile
sure.
to get the right guys upgrading at
right.
the right time with
yeah.
the right sorties. It's a very, I mean, it's a, and deployments and TDYs,
right.
like a very complex
yeah,
thing
to Yeah, it was.
But and talk to me about the Sandy mission.
Yeah, so to get, to put one of those together is akin to putting together a big strike package. You know, it takes a lot of assets. It takes a lot of coordination. And when we were at Moody, you know, we had HC-130s, HH-60s, and you would think that we would just constantly do that. But between, you know, upgrading pilots to flight leads and HC-130 upgrades, and HH-60 guys doing stuff, it was a pretty difficult thing to get to training. So that was, but we did, you know, push to do it. The Sandy mission, search and rescue, we fly as the Sandy call sign. It can be really any number of aircraft, but the general package is a four ship. So you have Sandy 1, who's the commander of the Sandy, and then through Sandy 4. Sandy 3 and 4 are generally assigned, I'll try to just simplify it a little bit, are generally assigned to escort the rescue vehicle, whatever it is, whether it's a convoy or a helicopter or whatever, to the target area. So whereas Sandy 1 is the overall commander, so he's running everything. And Sandy 2, as his wingman, is generally, he's there to kind of assist Sandy 1. Sandy 1's primary goal is to locate and authenticate the person on the ground who we're trying to recover, you know, so Jack, as we call him.
Yeah.
Sandy 2 is probably the busiest because while Sandy 1 is focused on that, his job is to take as much as he can off of Sandy 1's plate and do the coordination with the Sandy 3 element to make sure that they're routing and timing and everything to get to the area is safe. So yeah, it's a
super complex mission.
It really is, yeah. And then to be honest, the Sandy 3 mission is very different than the Sandy 1 and 2, so it's almost two separate kind of upgrades.
Because so it's like a Sandy 3 and Sandy 4, you're escorting, or your primary focus is escorting those HH-60s or the rescue platform,
right.
maybe a CV-22 or
sure. yeah.
whatever it might be. But you're also flying in formation, you know,
sure.
and there's helicopters that are moving along at
yeah.
probably a relatively slow clip compared to an A-10. I'll save my A-10 speed joke.
Sure, yep.
But obviously the A-10's very well suited for that
sure,
and being able
yeah.
to stick with those
right.
escort
and
vehicles.
You got that. So we want to keep, you always want to keep something pointed downrange in case of a pop-up threat. You know, there's a threat to a helicopter is much different than a threat to an airplane, right? So they're
yeah.
just the speed and the altitudes and things like that. So as the rescue lead, you're trying to look out ahead of the helicopter and make sure you're making a safe path for them to get into the target area.
How long does it take for someone to go through an upgrade like that? Like if you're going to go through, and like let's assume no, like what's an ideal scenario? No TDYs, no deployments.
Sure.
Like what do you think that timeline would be?
You know, you can upgrade to a Sandy 4 as a wingman. You know, that's
okay.
a wingman job. So it's he's basically there to provide mutual support to Sandy 3. So it's not a leadership role per se. So you're gonna upgrade to Sandy 4 as a wingman. You got to be a flight lead at least to be a Sandy 3, and then you know Sandy 2 and Sandy 1 are usually, you know, highly experienced four-ship flight leads to instructor pilots. And then obviously you need a Sandy instructor as well. So it's you know, just the flights wouldn't honestly take that long, but it's like different levels of experience that you would go a long way. So I would say a Sandy 1 has probably been flying the A-10 for 6 years, five or six years generally, yeah.
Yeah, long time to get someone to the point where they're able to
right.
lead that mission.
Right, akin to maybe like a mission commander in a strike package. So
okay.
Experienced guy who's seen a lot of it, so.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So if you're watching this, obviously the backdrop changed. We
right.
went back in time from a Mustang to a Stearman. But the audio, again, we're at Sun and Fun.
Sure.
The announcer started kicking off, so we had to move spots. With that, Habu, we were starting to jump into talking about rescort, so
yeah.
combat search and rescue.
Sure.
So rescue escort, you know, we got to make an acronym or shorten everything up
right.
in the
rescue
military.
Escort, yeah.
yeah, rescue escort.
I learned that in the Navy because that's, instead of acronyms, they just smash words together in the Navy. So, you know, the instrument procedures was op nav inst, you know, so short for something, five words. partially put together. But
it's actually impressive. I heard an acronym, it was like Iceman the other day, which is like some super nerdy engineering term, like how does anyone come up with this stuff? You know, it's yeah. actually rather amazing. But
sure.
we were jumping into that. So I wanted to break down Sandy. What is the Sandy call sign? Sandy 1, 2, 3, 4. How long does it take? Can you kind of break down combat search and rescue?
Sure.
Sandy, how the ATIM fits in it. So super easy.
Yeah.
Not a complex topic.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it goes, back in time, as long as we've had airplanes, we've had people trapped behind enemy lines. And the Sandy mission evolved as, a way to bring those people home. And, the reason for that is, we pay a lot of money for our pilots. We value our pilots' lives. And it also gives them the confidence that they can go into battle knowing that if something happens to them, somebody's going to come and get them. So, the Sandy call sign is what we fly for our search and rescue mission. So combat search and rescue. Really, our job in that is to locate the survivor, isolate them from any threats, and then find a way to get them back and repatriate them. So I was not a Sandy 1, but I did have some experience with it. The general breakdown, it can be anywhere from, it's typically 4 airplanes, sometimes 6, depending on, what's available. And a lot of times they'll involve other airplanes that they're in a Sandy mission, but they're not part of the Sandy package to do diversionary strikes or assist in different ways. But the general breakdown is Sandy 1 is the mission commander who is basically, his main focus is on the person or people who are on the ground who need to be recovered. So locating them, authenticating them, and making sure that he's just overseeing the entire mission. Sandy 2 flies as his wingman, and it does a lot of the data keeping and transferring information from the Sandy 1 element, which is the 2 planes, to the Sandy 3 element, which is generally tasked to providing escort of whatever rescue platform it may be, typically a helicopter or an Osprey or something like that. But it could be a Stryker vehicle on the ground that we can get a hold of. So anybody that has a path to pick that guy up would be the sole responsibility of the Sandy 3 element. So that's the general breakdown of it. Like I said, it's flexible depending on the mission and how many people and all that stuff. But that's kind of the general breakdown of it.
How long does it take someone to go through, Sandy 4 to Sandy 1?
Sure.
What would be an ideal timeline for that?
It's depending on the experience level of the pilot. So you can be a Sandy 4 as a new wingman, right? So a lot of times we'll get guys who are just out of the B course that are doing well. They get selected for a Sandy 4 upgrade. And a Sandy call sign is it's a badge of honor to be part of that CSAR mission. So not every A-10 pilot is a Sandy. It's an upgrade for us. But a Sandy 4 flies as the wingman providing mutual support to Sandy 3, who is the lead guy providing the escort. So that can be a wingman. A Sandy 3 has to at least be a 2-ship flight lead because he's got to lead the flight of the 2 there. And so it's pretty common for a high-performing 2-ship flight lead to get selected to a Sandy 3 upgrade. Then your Sandy 1s and Sandy 2s are typically 4-ship flight leads and instructors, guys with a little more experience who've flown the Sandy mission a few times. It's a pretty in-depth upgrade and there's a lot to it. So, Sandy 2, generally 4-ship instructor pilot. Lead Sandy is usually the weapons officer of the squadron, so he's got a lot of experience in it.
Yeah, it's a complex thing to go through, not to mention you're obviously managing deployments, TDYs,
yeah.
normal flight lead upgrades,
sure.
doing close air support, and
right.
learning all the weapons and how to employ the weapons.
Sure.
Things.
Just the amount of assets that it takes to coordinate to get that to happen, an HH-60, or an HC-130, there's multiple platforms, and we try our best to integrate and understand those each other's capabilities. And we do it so infrequently that there's very seldom just a Sandy mission that's not somebody's upgrade. So somebody's new in the position that they're learning because it takes so much to put it together. So it's very infrequent. We just go out there and practice it.
That's what we call it, like CT, continuation
CT,
training,
yeah.
Where you got two guys who are like fully qualified in that position,
right.
not doing an upgrade ride.
Sure.
Because again, there's just not many opportunities to get all the upgrades done that you need inside
right.
a squadron. So
yeah.
CT is always a nice thing because you can kind of have a gentleman brief and debrief, usually,
sure.
depending on how it goes.
Yeah.
And you're not having to do an in-depth.
Right.
Students doing the debrief, then the instructors doing the debrief, taking 6 hours.
So at Davis Monthan, where I retired out of, they have an exercise there called Angel Thunder. it's a big a red flag rescue is another name for it, and they bring people from all over the place with just a focus for a couple weeks on doing search.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
Rescue. So one of the good deals that I was able to get was I went down to Colombia to teach CSAR with the Colombian Air Force. And then I was, because I had a lot of experience going TDY as a demo pilot and stuff, I was tasked with flying with them with their sixth ship from Colombia back to Arizona. So it was day hop on these A-29 Super Tucanos, which was pretty
just
cool.
Jumping up from Colombia?
Yeah, yeah. We went from Central Colombia to Northern Colombia, stopped in Kingston, Jamaica for gas, stopped at Homestead, you know, and then through Pensacola, San Antonio, and then eventually in. But it was that was a great experience.
I did the air show in Rio Negro, Colombia. Okay. I didn't think my team was going to leave.
Yeah.
But yeah, just a phenomenal time down there. And then seeing the Colombians as they're progressing and coming up, I know they're looking for a new fighter because they fly the Kafir.
Yep.
But I think it's time probably for them to upgrade an F-16 or whatever.
They love the Super Tucano, and that it was a very young and very highly trained squadron. I was really impressed by their professionalism and the amount of training. Just their inquisitiveness. They were, you know, asking me questions all the time about tactics and how we do this and how can they do this better and just searching for feedback. And I was just really impressed by them for a very young squadron, you know.
Different world too. Like, I mean, they're fighting in their backyard.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's something.
Yeah, so on the ramp, you know, there were, you know, several A-29s that were just set up for training missions and then, you know, four others that had live bombs on them. And that's just part of the deal. Like, some days you're going out to do live stuff and some days it's, you know, just a training mission. So
yeah, man, that's wild. What do you think about the future of combat search and rescue? I mean, the fights seems to be changing and
yeah, you know, I think it's always going to be a capability that we need to have because it's not just airplanes. You know, we've used combat search and rescue for multiple other things other than just pilots being behind enemy lines. So it's definitely a capability that we need to retain. And if not for the fact that we're losing pilots, just for the fact that, like I said, that confidence of knowing that I'm gonna be willing to push across the line, knowing that if it goes poorly, I'm not just left. You know, I know that someone's gonna come get me and they value me. And I mean, there's our CSAR professionals really take that seriously, that, you know, that whole lifestyle that others may live, you know, that's what they say, so.
Yeah, I only had that brief time being a casual lieutenant waiting to go to pilot training in the HA-60 squadron, but that others may live, seeing like the dedication to the craft, integrating that once the A-10s came down to Moody and seeing combat search and rescue.
Sure.
And then, you know, you're hearing about it and you're talking about it, and that's a big part of it. When you're going to push across the line, if something bad happens, you know you're not going to be forgotten.
Sure.
And that the United States is going to make every effort
absolutely
possible to go in there and rescue you.
One of the really interesting things as we go into this unmanned part of our, you know, history is, you know, one of the, obviously it doesn't do you any good to to get a downed pilot and then lose three more or a helicopter
right
full of people on the way to pick them up. So, you know, some of the unmanned things that I'm hearing about, you know, unmanned rescue vehicle, pretty interesting, you know.
It's a wild time. It'll be interesting to see, you know, just, I mean, I joke, right? Like 15 years ago, the iPhone didn't exist, but we see how much our world has changed
sure
with the smartphone.
Yeah.
What ChatGPT, I mean, everyone's obviously talking about that a good bit. Like,
yeah,
things are rapidly changing, and I think it's just going to continue to evolve as, you know, the Air Force talks about next generation air dominance fighter,
right,
unmanned aerial systems, like,
sure,
yeah, it'll be a different time.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's always going to be conflict or the potential for conflict at very varying levels, right? We've got major combat operations, we've got next gen type of stuff, and then I think there are always going to be low intensity conflicts as well that, you know, require that. So.
Hey, so I want to pivot just a little bit. Let's talk about your first deployment in the A-10.
Yeah.
You went to Afghanistan, right?
I did, yep.
Can you talk to me about that time frame in Afghanistan, what that was like, big picture, and then we talk about some of the missions you were
sure
doing?
Sure, yeah. So I went my first deployment. So it was my second deployment. My first one was to Iraq for OIF, and then my second time was to Afghanistan. And to be honest, just to preface it, when I went to OIF, it was a very slow time period.
Okay.
The whole entire deployment, not much was going on. There was occasionally something would happen, So that was my mental model of what a conflict was like.
Right.
And then when I got to Afghanistan, I was a relatively new flight lead, showed up in Afghanistan on my very first mission in country. We ended up supporting the troops in contact, or a convoy had gotten hit, and it was just, I mean, hair on fire. I remember kind of coming off to the tanker and realizing I was breathing like I just ran a mile, you know, and it was definitely my heart beating, and it was, you know, thrown right into it. And it stayed generally pretty busy like that. Not all of it, but it stayed pretty busy. So,
well, it's all, I mean, again, rough, right? Could be 90% boredom, 10% pure adrenaline,
yeah,
and excitement,
sure,
flying a fighter. But doing some of those missions and close air support, Afghanistan, obviously, all these conflicts evolve year to year,
sure,
day to day, and things were going on. What was it like as far as like rules of engagement? You know, coming, you got the big old gun, which is a direct fire weapon, usually,
sure,
collateral damage estimate, CDE,
right,
is less of a concern,
right,
than dropping a 500-pound bomb. But there are definitely times, and I've talked about on the podcast, I think over the years, like civilian casualty is absolutely something you don't want to have happen.
Sure.
But we saw the enemy, you know, they can use the media just as we do, whether good or bad, or I mean, mostly,
sure,
bad, right? Where they're spinning, like, hey.
Yeah, take it to make it, use it to your advantage, right?
But you almost had to be a lawyer at certain points here, and some of the guys in the conflict when it came,
sure,
to employing weapons. Were you seeing any of that, or was it pretty?
In 2008 and 2009, it was less restrictive than the guys that went in the 11 and 12 timeframe, where it was, you know, there were a lot more, you know, stating the ROE that you're employing under and things like that. So I didn't have that. But it was still, you know, it was very interesting because the guys who were controlling our airstrikes were generally not on site, you know, so they were in the tactical operations center talking to us, and so we a lot of times were giving the picture to them for them to give the picture, the approval back to us to execute whatever, you know, whatever mission we were doing at the time. So that was interesting.
That's a different dynamic. That was my OIR deployment. You know, typically you're not talking to someone who's on the ground.
Sure.
Maybe someone on the ground is talking on a sat phone back to someone else who,
right,
then is talking to you, giving you the strike authority. Doing that communications ball back and forth obviously takes time and can induce certain,
sure,
challenges and,
yeah,
errors into the equation.
Yeah.
But but it's not uncommon that a unit might not have a JTAC, a Joint Terminal Air Attack Controller,
sure,
who is on the ground translating ground speak to pilot speak to make sure,
sure,
the bombs and the guns go in the right spot.
Right.
Were you seeing, I guess it's probably a mix probably of units that had JTACs incorporated and units that didn't have
JTACs? Yeah, we were always assigned to a JTAC on a frequency for everywhere, you know, but they were working zone defense, if you will,
right?
Right? So that we'd be supporting multiple different forward operating bases and talking to a certain JTAC, and we would contact them with things that we were hearing. And we would typically try to get a frequency of the guy who's actually on the ground there. But yeah, so there was a lot of, you know, radio techniques to affect the battlefield that we kind of evolved over time. Like, hey, I can talk to this guy. One of the interesting things that we started doing was when we would have, you know, Apaches in the area, we would learn their frequencies because they are part of the, you know, maneuver element. So they don't really need a JTAC approval to strike a target. But if we can see a target with a targeting pod, I can definitely laze a target that they can then strike, you know, without, and that's usually while we're waiting for the coordination to happen to step it up to the next level to shoot, you know, the 30 millimeter or drop a bomb.
I saw that because I did MC-12s in Afghanistan, so
yeah.
King Air. And I do remember one specific night, actually there were a couple nights where the Apaches were, you know, flying with that unit, and watching the Apache do work,
yeah,
is rather impressive. But was one particular night, we found a guy placing an IED, like, you know, hole in the center of the road,
sure,
straight line across, you know, the wire and everything. And by having that feed, and, you know, we're able to pump that feed back to Jock and then laze for,
yeah,
the Apaches who just pop up over the hillside, hit the laser spot, and then the IED,
yeah,
guys are no longer with us. So it's
my most memorable combat sortie involved working with Apaches, and it was just kind of an interesting mission, you know.
Yeah, tell me about that.
So the reason it was memorable, because it was really a mistake on my part from the get-go. We stepped out of operations going to a troops in contact. So we knew at the time we're going to support this fight. It was a dusk time. And that was usually when most of the fighting occurred. So the enemy knew that dusk period is where, hey, our visual looking out the window isn't great anymore, but our night vision goggles aren't really up to full effectiveness either. And it's also at the time of thermal crossover where the hot targets that are as the temperature changes from day to night, everything becomes kind of the same temperature. So your pod is limited, your NVGs aren't effective, and you can't really see down into the valleys. So we got sent out to the Coringall Valley where, you know, the guys were taking fire. And when that happens, you know, it's like you launch out and you're trying to get out of there as quick as you can. So sure enough, it happens to be a day where my number two engine doesn't start. So I have to step to a spare. So now I'm already like, you know, guys are on the ground, fighting's happening, they need us overhead. I have to step to a spare. So I say, tell the crew chief, hey, well, you grab all my stuff. I'm gonna go do the walk around on the other airplane. We'll hop in. Well, one of the things that we do, we put our night vision goggles in a little thing on the side of the cockpit. And I forgot about them because it was still light at this
right.
point, you know, so it was light. Got into the new airplane, launch out, and it's starting to get darker and darker. And I say, one's going, goggles on. I look down and I don't have night vision goggles. So we're in a troops in contact over the mountains in Afghanistan. And now I'm limited to the, you know, min safe altitude. So I'm stuck way up there, which for up there was, you know, 19 or 20,000 feet,
so,
which is, you know, nosebleed in an A-10.
Yeah.
So I got a wingman who's got night vision goggles. I don't. So I end up just holding high. And I'm looking as it gets darker and darker. I can see in my targeting pod, but I'm pretty much limited to level flight up there. And, you know, there's artillery. Apaches are checking in. There was a small convoy, like a detail, that got trapped out of the base and got attacked on their way back in. So we had to basically clear it so they could get back to the FOB. So we're trying to support them. And, you know, so we're doing yo-yo operations where there was periods of time so we could maintain constant coverage that my wingman would go to the tanker while I was on scene. And then back and forth where I would go. So I had to get on the tanker about four times with no NVGs and back to the fight, you know, and I'm just seeing through a soda straw on my screen.
Yeah.
I ended up dropping a JDAM just from a level, you know, but I was able to affect it by, you know, lasing targets for the Apaches that were there. And so it was pretty cool. Although it looks a lot different with no NVGs when you're seeing the real sparkles outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a sporty one.
Dude, that's wild. And that's the thing, too, like, I remember stepping to spares. We would typically step and start an hour prior to takeoff, which is significant.
Yep. Sure.
Be able to align your bombs. The bombs weren't aligned, and you had some system. But
yeah.
Even with that amount of time, yeah, depending on where you broke in that start sequence.
Sure.
I mean, I broke at like 50 minutes, you know,
right.
into that. Now, the amount of stuff you have for an eight-hour combat
yeah,
mission.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, one, just don't fall getting out of the jet going down the ladder, but
sure.
don't forget anything. Because again, you got to build your
yeah,
little nest.
You got your combat survival vest with your weapon and all that. And it's just, you just feel very, you know, bulky and
yeah.
you got map packs and all these things. So, you know, I was clearly my fault for not pre-flighting it, but I just was in such a hurry to get out there. It was so, and then to make matters worse, we're finally going back and we get a Chariot call to escort a helicopter from Bagram down to Kandahar. So now I have no night vision goggles and I have to use a targeting pod to escort this helicopter, you know, for whatever it is, 200 and some miles down to Kandahar.
And for those who know Chariot directs, like Chariot, that's
sure.
the CPAC, that's the
Combined yeah,
Forces
exactly.
Air Component Commander, the three-star who runs the
right.
entire air war. And so yep. when Chariot directs.
One of my longest combat sorties and had no NVGs the whole thing. So, you know, purely to my own fault. But.
Yeah, that's brutal. And again, just thinking around flying around in the mountains of Afghanistan at night,
yeah.
the challenges with that one in the A-10. And then when I hear you say you had to go find the tanker, this is something I didn't fully appreciate. Like in the F-16 and a Block 50 radar, and you have an interrogator,
right?
Which it's great to get a radar lock, but to have the interrogator to interrogate their
sure, to make walk, sure that it's
you're like, okay, I'm actually locked to the right thing. So
sure.
you go rejoin. Talk me through rejoining the A-10 at night in Afghanistan and Iraq. How does that work?
You know, we had a data link at the time, and we were, at the time, that was fairly new, but we actually would use the other airplanes sometimes, the radar-equipped airplanes, to put out a data link track to help us out.
Okay.
So if
yeah.
they could, you know, and if a strike eagle could lock a guy up and put a data link track out, and so that was helpful. But other than that, it was, you know, just GPS points in the sky, you know, and we'd talk about where they were in relation to that. So it was a lot of discussion about, hey, I'm on a 330, radial direct to at point whatever, you know, and all the refueling points were GPS points that were named, and so we'd have 1,000 feet of separation. And there was plenty of time when there was weather, you know, where we would circle around 1,000 feet below them, just trying to take the time to rejoin with them.
Yeah, just working your way up until you're 500 feet below them or whatever
yeah,
to
yeah.
hopefully.
You know, and I would typically try in an A-10, especially if I could climb up high and build some energy so that when I found the tanker from high to low, I'd have a little bit of excess energy to, because in an A-10 trying to climb up at medium altitude to join a tanker, you know, it's a losing game pretty much. So,
well, it's funny, even in F-16, you know, combat, like for some reason the tankers occasionally find themselves up in the high 20s,
right?
And you're out of min AB, sure, just to stay on the boom. You're like, right, am I actually gaining gas right now, or am I just throwing up gas? And then
so we obviously didn't have the afterburner, so our technique for that was called a toboggan. So what we would do is have the tanker start a descent, you know, they would just start a slow vertical speed descent, and that would allow us with a little bit of extra, you know, to stay on the boom. So yeah, it was interesting, you know. And if the tanker was heavy, they would oftentimes have to put flaps out to fly slow enough, you know, to fly with us.
That's awesome. I did rejoin on a tanker that was refueling F-18s at night, and I was not aware they were refueling F-18, so I came in with about 150 knots of my normal smash that I could kill pretty quick. Sure. And then turns out I had like 250 knots of smash. So
right.
It's a, you know,
well,
it's
I had an interesting one on the tanker as well. I'm not painting myself in the best light here, but so when you're refueling so much, it just gets to be second nature, and your mind's kind of on, you know, what's going on the ground and getting back quickly. So I find this tanker, I've got a nice high to low rejoin. I'm going to scream in there. I'm just going to park it in, get gas and go. And so I do this fairly tight rejoin. I pull a lot of G's to kind of, you know, slow down so I can just park it right in there. And I reach up, and our air refueling handle and the gear handle are pretty close, and it's kind of the same motion. So I'm looking up to try to rejoin with this guy, and I just reached and grabbed the landing gear handle. So I put the landing gear down at, you know, at 20,000 feet. And I looked down, and I was right at the gear speed. So it actually didn't even overspeed the gear, because I had put, you know, burned off so much energy in the turn. But I can only imagine the boomer, you know, seeing me like this, and the landing gear comes down, and then the guy just gone. So it's 5 or 10 minutes again until I can catch up to him.
I instantly regret this. Yeah. I wish I could get those knots back.
Yeah.
I love those type stories, because I think it also, like, we all make, like, those, some would say, like, 1,000 of those are happening, right? And you're just kind of like, learn from them, and then it's also a good take. Like, there are guys who, unfortunately, because the AR door and the Vipers back here off the left, well, the fuel master fuel cutoff switch, which is safety wired,
sure,
is conveniently located right next to it.
Yeah.
So there are stories that guys have, unfortunately,
sure,
fuel cut off, and then it gets real quiet,
yeah,
in the,
sure,
jet pretty quick. So not what you want. But you come back from Afghanistan. Can you talk to me a little bit about your career? Because you eventually end up doing demo.
Yeah.
So I guess it's kind of parallel.
So I deployed to Afghanistan. I'd been at Moody Air Force Base for close to 3 years by that point. And they had, at the time, they had an A-10 East and an A-10 West demo team. And one of the guys who was the current demo pilot, Dusty Green, was, you know, a guy that I got along with pretty well. And I just kind of learned a little bit about it. And, you know, he was coming up on the end of his demo tour. It was just something that was interesting to me. So I, you know, the group commander said, hey, if you're interested in doing demo, put your name in the hat. And I did. And I was lucky enough to get picked up to do it, which was, you know, pretty cool. So I got to, yeah, I got to tour along with Dusty towards the end of his career and go to several shows and learn from him. And it was really interesting. He was so well respected in the demo community, and he was just did a great job of introducing me to people and making me feel welcome. And so by the time I did my upgrade and started on the demo circuit, I felt like I knew quite a few people, and it was, you know, it was, he really paved that way for me to, it's pretty smoothly.
It's pretty cool. I mean, I think it's a testament too, like, we're still connected to the air show,
yeah,
world. Like,
absolutely.
It's a fun,
sure,
it's a fun group of people, but it does lend to, obviously, being immersed in it. It's super helpful when you have someone who's teaching you, obviously, to fly the demo, but then all the other stuff that comes along with it, like introducing you, meeting, and helping you kind of, sure, get a foothold.
Yeah, nobody, you know, nobody can really make it in here without the help. There's, you know, and the demo and the air show community is really tight knit, you know, and I'm still in contact with those people. So I'm actually here with Jive Kirby,
yep,
who was one of my, you know, flying mentors and one of my kind of my personal heroes, you know.
He flies so many planes.
Yeah, he just does everything. And he's an amazing pilot, and he's been, you know, they've always just treated me really well. And so I'm helping out here, and so pretty glad to have made those connections to do this. So.
Yeah, that's awesome. So in doing demo, you happen to get hit with sequestration at that time. What were those demo years like? You got any like highlights from it, like really good memories, best part of it?
Yeah, so my first year was pretty normal, although there was a lot of discussion about, hey, the Air Force budget, and, you know, are we gonna keep this? So it was looming a little bit. And then at the end of the first year, they said, hey, we're gonna cut the demo teams, but we wanna keep the Air Force Heritage flight. And so the first year I had 30 shows on the schedule, and then the second year was 10. And I went from being a fully you know, very competent and experienced at that point demo pilot to only being able to do 3 non-aerobatic passes and then the heritage flight. So it was a little bit frustrating, but, you know, still a great experience for me. It was just, it was difficult to see where the decisions were being made because across the Air Force, budgets were tight, you know, so obviously our defending our country is a priority, but honestly, a very close second to that is, you know, prepping the next generation and also, you know, marketing our capabilities to the people that we defend, you know, so the people, even the people that aren't going to join the Air Force are taxpayers and they deserve to know that there's some of the best people in the country right. are out there defending them. So
what do you think the hardest part of the demo / air show world was for you?
It was constantly being in a new place and, you know, every week reinventing small procedures. So you would show up at a site with, you're parked in a different place, you've got a different set of people that you're supposed to be talking to. So the logistics, and as great as my maintainers and my team chiefs were, you know, it was just still trying to figure out how to get in and out of the show and how to get who you're supposed to talk to for what. And you had to be pretty creative on the road because you didn't have the full complement of maintenance things. And so, you know, these guys were awesome. My maintainers would, they would just make stuff happen, you know, and find, you know, I remember one time driving, somebody drove a wheel down in the back of their own truck, you know, to put on the jet. So
I think I had, I mean, many stories like that because it is the maintainers that make it happen.
Absolutely.
And what's incredible, but I had my first like 3 air shows, I hard broke and I mean, significant maintenance, brake failures, all sorts of stuff. I landed my 3rd show. I did a low level into the show. It was a great day.
Yeah.
Land, I'm like, it's code 1, fellas. You're welcome. I didn't break this one.
Yeah.
And then we had an assistant, Pro Soup, there who's helping us out. He walks around the jet and he's just shaking his head. The back leading edge of the horizontal stab had delaminated.
Oh, no.
It was digging into the fuselage.
Oh, no.
So we ended up having one of our guys drive down the part. But what was really cool to see, we're on a Marine base. There might be like 100 like Phillips head fasteners that attach this thing.
Right.
And they're all epoxy. So they had to carve out each one of those Phillips heads with a little razor blade. It was impressive to see those guys do it. The Marines jumped in. Our guys jumped in. And in a matter of like 2 hours, it was done. Normally, it's something that takes 12 hours.
Sure.
Just carving out epoxy from this to change it out.
Right.
But the ingenuity, the forward thinking, and like the push it up from the maintainers for me was the best part because it helped address some of those shortfalls and challenges.
Right.
Like you said, like, where am I parking? This is different. I broke something. How do I, you know, you just don't have those support assets.
You know, and I would say to the maintainers who might be listening to the podcast that one thing I just grew a deep appreciation for them because a lot of times we step out, you know, say I'm going to do a Sandy upgrade. My mind is full. You know, I've got times, I've got people to talk to, I've got all these things. And so unfortunately, sometimes we don't have the time or take the time to really show our appreciation to the maintainers, but we do. And you can, you know, you and I can both say that we know, especially when I got to spend some more time off duty with these guys to just to see how serious they took their jobs, how professional they were, just what great humans they were. I'm still good friends with all of them, you know, and so I would say that sometimes we owe those guys this just to tell them that they're super appreciated and we don't, when we're stepping and we're late and all these things are going on, we don't always get the chance to express that. But
that is a phenomenal point because I think you're 100% right. It wouldn't happen without them, but to see their dedication, that's the cool part about demo. There were times where you know, like I would always want to go out on the flight line when I was in the combat squadron and hang out for 4 hours with the maintenance guys. The time just isn't there between, you know, doing your additional duty, mission planning, upgrades, briefing, debriefings. You just can't make it happen.
Sure.
Demo, you're still busy, but there are a couple times where I could sneak out weather days. I remember one time we had 3 demo jets, all 3 motors pulled from them. And yeah, they let me like turn a wrench, and like pat me on the back, say, hey, good job, you know, now get out of the way. But it's fun to be able to go out there and really kind of immerse and see what they're doing. You're pulling a, you know, $7 million motor out of the back of this plane, and you're sliding a new one in there, like
And you know that my life depends on it. You know, I'm gonna go take this jet in front of all these people, and you have that level of professionalism to make sure that it's important to you as it is to me. That was actually one of the things I really enjoyed. Also, is like once in a while getting out there and the panels are open, and hey, what is this? Yeah. What is, you know, that, because we also don't get to put our hands inside the guts of the jet very often.
Right.
You know, we show up and they've got it ready and it's you know, ready to go. So I got pretty good at safety wiring the
that's awesome.
The travel pod, you know?
So, yeah. Well, again, you don't get to see it because everyone's doing their job and there's no time to really do anything else. And I'll say, name drop, Stephen Mullins, he was my avionics tech for the first year. But I remember we had, so in the Viper, one of the things you do, you have a pinky switch to move the throttle to off, but you have okay. to pull that pinky switch, rotate the throttle out to shut the motor down.
Okay.
One of the things you do before you even start the jet is to rotate that and make sure you can't do it. We just got a new jet that had just been flying BFM and another squadron. I get in the jet, I rotate it and rip the throttle right off without engaging the pinky switch. Like, not a good thing if you're in a high aspect fight and you're ripping to idle and going to max back and forth, because you can shut the engine down. But I remember sitting in my office and right, you know, the jets are right behind me, and Steven, I think for like 8 hours, freezing cold day, he's just hung upside down over the ladder, changing out and running all the wires, you know.
Yeah.
It's not an easy thing to do all these different chain, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible stuff to see these guys work. So
it takes a lot of patience, you know, to get in there sometimes, like, what? Why is this? Who designed this? You know, like, how did this put this bolt back here, you know?
It takes this one special cable and, like, small person to get it done. It's incredible to see what the maintainers do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Habu, before we wrap up here, man, I always like to ask guests, have you found 15, 16-year-old Habu walking down the street? Is there any advice, tips or tricks, something you tell them to do different?
Oh, man, plenty of things.
Softball question, man.
You know, I think I will say that mistakes that I've made along the way have been the things that put me where I am, you know. So sometimes, you know, I wanted to be a pilot right out of, you know, out of school. Didn't happen for me, but I knew that that was something I wanted to pursue. And I think back a lot, you know, if I had gone straight to pilot training, would I have gotten in the A-10? Would I have flown this? Or would I have had the experience or the maturity at the time to do it? And so, you know, there's, I wouldn't say that I have regrets. I have things that I would do differently or mistakes that I've made, but I have thought about it. And that's, you know, the one thing I mentioned earlier was to tell other people is all of the things that you can control, maximize those, right? You can keep yourself physically fit. You can work on your grades. You can do all those things. And then that added with just being a humble, willing to learn kind of person, and your world's going to be your oyster, you know?
Dude, perfect note to finish on, Habu, man. I really appreciate it. Thanks for the bottle of Jack.
Absolutely.
I'm glad you were able to go hang out in Dubai for that. That was, again, a fun air show when I did it. So
yeah.
Glad you enjoyed it.
No, it's great running into you here, man. It's a perfect platform to come see all this, you know, and once you get the bug for seeing air shows and all the different airplanes and the things that are out here and the people behind them, it's, you know, you kind of get addicted to coming out here. And
yeah, I know, and we just scratched the surface. We didn't even talk about, like I mentioned before, like the Indy 500 flyover. Mix, you know, Vipers and A-10s and all that stuff, man.
You know, I mentioned it to you off camera before we started that, you know, I retired a year ago, and it's finally having a little bit more time to reflect of the things that we got to do, you know. And like, man, I was young and I was getting paid to fly this, you know, amazing historical aircraft that's going to go down as one of the best, you know, platforms in our country's history, probably in the history of the world, right? Very unique airplane, very unique mission set. And I was getting paid to do that. And then I was getting paid to do it and fly in formation with, you know, historical World War II aircraft and the people who fly those who are also just amazing, you know? So I've had a little bit more downtime to sit back and go, that was pretty cool, you know?
It's tough to pull yourself out, you know, and take a, you know, 50,000 foot view when you're down in the weeds, but man, it's pretty good world. So
yeah,
Habu,
absolutely.
I appreciate
you having me, man.
Thanks, brother.
Take care.
Cheers.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
I want to tell you about a service I've been using for over a year now, Aurora. I signed up and they immediately identified over 60 data brokers out there selling my information. The best part is they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. I have a link down below where you get a 14-day free trial. It's risk-free and you can cancel anytime. So it's worth taking a shot and seeing what information is out there. But it's more than just that. They have an app which includes antivirus, VPN, password management, all built into one package. You can use the app or you can use the browser to stay safe out there in the digital space. Again, I have a link down below. You can check it out for 2 weeks free. And if you don't like it, you can cancel anytime.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home.
At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.